This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
George Floyd, 46, died after being arrested by police outside a shop in Minneapolis in Minnesota. Footage of the arrest on the 25th of May shows a white police officer, Derek Chauvin, kneeling on Mr. Floyd's neck while he was pinned to the floor. Chauvin, 44, has since been charged with murder. The key events that led to Floyd's death happened within just 30 minutes. Based on accounts from witnesses, video footage and official statement, here's what we know so far. It began with a report of a fake $20 bill. A report was made on the evening of the 25th of May when Floyd bought a pack of cigarettes from a grocery store, believing that the $20 bill he used to be a counterfeit. A store employee reported it to the police. Mr. Floyd had been living in that area for several years after moving there from his native Houston, Texas. He had recently been working as a bouncer in the city, but like millions of other Americans, he was left jobless by the coronavirus pandemic. Floyd was a regular at that particular supermarket. He was a friendly face, a pleasant customer who never caused any trouble. The store owner actually confirmed to NBC to that effect, NBC broadcaster. But the store owner was not at work on the day of the incident. In reporting the suspicious bill, his teenage employee was just following protocol, we are told. He made a call to 911 at around a minute past 8. The employee told the operator he had demanded the cigarettes back, but he doesn't want to do that. According to a transcript released by authorities, the employee said the man appeared drunk and not in control of himself. Shortly after the call, at around 8 minutes past 8 in the evening, two police officers arrived. Mr. Floyd was sitting with two other people in a car parked around the corner. After approaching the car, one of the officers pulled out his gun and ordered Mr. Floyd to show his hands. In an account of the incident, prosecutors do not explain why the police officer thought it was necessary to draw his gun. And once handcuffed, Mr. Floyd became compliant, we are told, while the police officer explained that he was being arrested for passing counterfeit currency. It was when officers tried to put Mr. Floyd in the squad car that a struggle ensued. At around 14 minutes past 8, Mr. Floyd stiffened up, fell to the ground and told officers he was claustrophobic, according to the report. The police that arrived at this, the other police had arrived at the scene and, in an attempt to put Mr. Floyd into the police car. And during this attempt, at around 19 minutes past 8, we are told that the policeman pulled Mr. Floyd out of the passenger side, causing him to fall on the ground. He lay there face down, still in handcuffs. That's when witnesses started to film Mr. Floyd, who appeared to be in a distressed state. These moments, captured on multiple mobile phones and shared widely on social media, would prove to be Mr. Floyd's last. Mr. Floyd was restrained by officers while the policeman placed his knee, left knee, between his head and neck. And Mr. Floyd said, "I can't breathe," repeatedly, pleading for his mother and begging, "Please, please, please." For 8 minutes and 46 seconds, the policeman kept his knee on Mr. Floyd's neck. The prosecutor's report says that. About 6 minutes into that period, Mr. Floyd became non-responsive. In videos of the incident, this was when Mr. Floyd fell silent as bystanders urged the policeman to check his pulse. One of the officers, after checking his pulse on the wrist, said, "I couldn't find one," referring to the pulse. And then an ambulance was called, and then an hour later, he was gone. He was just gone. And America is angry. People in different states of America have gone on a rampage. And, you know, it does not help that Donald Trump spoke about how when people loot, the shooting will start as well. So there's just anger all over America. Now we go to America and speak to Destiny Brown, who's a student at Ohio University in the U.S. Destiny, good morning to you. South Africa time. How are you?
Good morning. It's currently 4:13 a.m.
Wow.
It's really early here.
Thank you for waking up. Thank you for talking to us. Must be a difficult time in America as we speak, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a day by day. We don't know what's going to happen, but it's just so many unknown things, but there's a lot of upset people on all levels in every single state in this country.
How has the behavior changed? Because even some, you know, people who are popular have been saying, guys, let's protest, but let us not loot. Because when we loot, we take away, you know, the essence of why we are on the streets.
Yeah, I honestly don't believe that it's right to, you know, criticize how people are coming together and advocating for people. I don't support the looting of Black-owned businesses. We need those businesses to continue our pursuit of economic prosperity in this country. Just how our system has been designed to not support us like that. So I do not support that at all, and I will verbally say that. But as for everything else that goes on, I cannot say that it is fair and it is my right to ever criticize how other people decide to come together amongst themselves and really protest against what's going on. Everyone has their emotions. Everyone has their reactions. And I believe that everyone is fair in how they decide to deal with everything that they've had fester inside of them from years and decades and hundreds of years of injustices in this country.
Has the anger subsided, or do you think that this is likely to carry on for another, you know, long period of time?
If you have been able to see what protesters on the ground are surfacing on the protests and not what the media and the United States mainstream media is releasing, you will see that most of the protests begin nonviolent. Most people are peaceful. Some people even have silent demonstrations. Mm. And what we see is that the police are the ones coming in and creating these protests against racial injustice into riots, or if that's what you want to call it, what the media wants to call it. We see that there are Americans putting themselves at the front lines, but not antagonizing the police in any way, and are still being met with force. They're meeting nonviolence with violence. The police are the ones changing these protests into riots and really enraging people further. And there have been curfews initiated. So if you are past curfew, you will be arrested. Mm. There have been National Guard present in a lot of different cities. I think 13 cities across the nation called for their National Guard. And I believe that will continue to rise. In Washington, D.C., there's a lot of protests at the gates of the White House. So it's important to understand that this is a national protest, and the same tactics of using force against nonviolence and really escalating that violence that is we know were never actually designed to do so.
Are you convinced that this time around the message that says enough is enough would be heeded too? That we'll begin to see real changing as far as police conduct is concerned against the Black man in America?
Yeah, I think it's important to recognize that it's happening to Black men, Black women, Black transgender people, Black LGBTQI people, all kinds of people, Black children, Black elderly, Black poor, Black rich, Black educated, Black uneducated. These injustices are happening to everybody, and everyone is upset. But I do think that there, as long as people organized locally around policy change and legislation change and challenging the systemic issues behind everything they're doing with their protests, whether it be nonviolent or violent, I think that is really what's going to gain traction, that conversation around long-term change, around challenging the laws and policies in our country is really where the protests are gaining momentum, because not only are they seeing what's going on, but I think in the media, but I think that each side, whether I don't want to discuss like the debate on if I support nonviolence or violence, but I do think it's important to understand that both of these fronts and these fights have the same goal, and that they're uplifting each other in the immediacy of these changes, and that they're backed up by demands from cities to their leaders to really start enacting policy change and really do that with immediacy, because people are finally at their breaking point.
Does it help that Donald Trump seems to be taking a particular side in as far as this issue is concerned?
Yeah, it does not help. I believe that Donald Trump is antagonizing the police even further, heightening their tensions with protesters, as well as influencing white supremacists in our country to rise up, to come amongst these protests and really start a lot of the violent tactics. It's really interesting to see how many white people have been behind the first ones to initiate any violent vandalization in any city. It's really interesting to see how they are the first ones really to start that, and people latch onto it. So I don't know necessarily, and I don't want to put white people against black people right now, because that allyship and that solidarity is very important, but I do not think it's something that you can really ignore. But I do think that Donald Trump is really influencing this to spread and become something much larger and much more violent with his words and his rhetoric.
Does it mean that, you know, Americans, particularly those that are taking to the streets, are now less concerned about the coronavirus pandemic, because the U.S. has got, one of the highest numbers in the world? Yes, I have seen people wearing masks, but, you know, I've not seen, not everybody's wearing a mask, among others. And forget about, social distancing, because this is a protest which is mired in anger and emotions as well. But, you know, to what sense is that being considered?
The protest that myself and so many others have helped organize in Indianapolis, we stress the importance of trying to stay away from each other and social distance. I tried myself to keep my distance at all times. But I think it's important that racism is also a virus that is killing people, especially black people, at disproportionate rates, what the COVID-19 virus is already doing. So I think people are also outraged that in the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of protocol for us to stay home, we have to come out here and protest. I think it's something people should be more mindful of, considering that there are people that are not protecting themselves, but I think wearing masks is an effective way. But I do want people to be more safe at these protests and really gather in spaces where social distancing protocol is followed, so that we're not also being hit by a second wave of this pandemic alongside fighting for this right, our rights as citizens in this country, for black people to just want equality. I really do want to emphasize that is still amongst us, and black people in this country are dying at disproportionate rates, are getting infected at disproportionate rates by this virus as well. So I really hope that's something that people are more mindful of moving forward.
Destiny Brown, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. Please be safe.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you very much. Destiny Brown, student at Ohio State University, one of the protesters or one of the people that participates in the protests in Indianapolis in the U.S. 22 minutes after 10.
Power Talk, 9 a.m. to noon.
23 minutes after 10. So at 11 o'clock, if Mom Angie makes it, we will beam it live for you so that you can hear from the horse's mouth you know, in terms of the plans that she's got in store for us as a country with regards to the preparedness of the education system in the midst of this pandemic. But we continue to talk about the issue of the passing or the killing or the murder of George Floyd in the US, because it you know, racism affects even us in South Africa, even though we are a majority. And, you know, racism is a problem almost everywhere on the planet, particularly against black people. So to talk further about this, we are joined by Siseko Khumalo, editor of Journal of Decolonizing Disciplines. Siseko, good morning.
Good morning, sir. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you for your time. We also have political analyst Mechi Makhoba. Good morning.
Good morning.
So let me start with you, Siseko. I mean, I couldn't help but admire the solidarity of white Americans who were putting their body on the line as well, you know, who were also carrying those placards that said Black Lives Matter. And these are not people who were standing at the back. These were people who were confronting the police, who were carrying this particular message. And I was a little bit envious because, you know, we don't see white people in this country in the main saying what had happened to Khosa in Alexander is something that must enrage all of us in this country. And, you know, later on, I want us also to focus on the fact that also as South Africans, we seem to have shifted the responsibility of voicing ourselves to Twitter, to Black Twitter, which has done well. But what happened to expressing ourselves about so many injustices that we face in the streets in big numbers? What happened to that era? But let's start first with the solidarity issue. Are we going to get there, or is it something that we must forget about?
Thanks, Tabitha. I think one of the critical things that I will suggest in the first instance is to say that globally, black life has been cheapened by the capitalist system that we live in, right? Mm. So, and we see this, of course, as far back as the slavery age, right, where it was black bodies that built up American civilization. I hear all the white rights positions saying that whiteness has built up America. It was black bodies that built up that society, black bodies that were out on the cotton fields, black bodies that were out building the cities of America. And it's the same thing here at home in the South African context. But it's much more interesting in the South African context because I do believe that South Africa falls into that category of the post-colony. And I use post in inverted air quotes here because honestly, I don't think we're in a post-colony. And the post-colony, of course, as Frantz Fanon suggests, is much, much more troubled and much more characterized by racial difference than the metropole, right? So we can understand maybe the United States of America to be the metropole and the South African context to be the post-colony. And the post-colony or the colonial context in our situation is such that blackness continues to be cheapened in the eyes of whiteness in this country, right? So when you bring up the case of Ukorin's Khosa, who was assaulted by the SANDF, and the silence that we saw from whiteness in this country speaks directly to that particular question of, you know, in many instances, I hold, and this is my own particular view, but I hold that in the South African context, whiteness continues in many ways to dehumanize blackness, right? Through the ways in which whiteness interacts with blackness, through the ways in which whiteness speaks about blackness in this country, et cetera, et cetera. So when a black body, when a black person dies in this country, whiteness is disaffected because in many instances they don't, the issues that plague black lives in South Africa are not in the least bit concerning to whiteness in this country. So it's, for me, it's not alarming, it's not something interesting, or it's not something new to have this white silence. White silence and black issues in this country has always been the norm. And to answer your question of will we ever get to a solidarity in South Africa, there's a possibility, but personally, I'm very, very suspicious of whiteness in general. I am very, very suspicious.
What do you think, Makhoba?
I think what's really happening in the USA is just a continuation of slavery and colonialism, where black lives have suffered a social death. And in that space, they are, especially black men, their death becomes necessary because of what white supremacy has done to the black body. And that's where we say our lives are cheap, because all we can do is provide cheap labor to capitalism. And as a result, this is something that is going to be continuing. And it's even worse in the U.S. because black people in the U.S. are a cultural and numeric minority, which means they don't even have the numbers to challenge the system of white supremacy, which is embedded in the education system, the legal system, and all the sectors of the economy. And that becomes much, much different in South Africa, where we see the practices of and values of white supremacy being actually practiced by our own black people. Because if you look at the police system in South Africa and the military force, their practices have not transformed to look at black people as humans. We do have police and soldiers working in those institutions, but the institutional practices that are guiding those institutions remain colonial and racist. So even if a black person is going to be working in such spaces, the way they see the black person through the outside, it still remains. That's why you see all these situations where in the U.S. there's a strong left, which can actually protest in solidarity to black people in America. But you won't see that in South Africa, because people who are perpetuating violence could be Africans, because we actually see ourselves through the outsider, which is the eyes of white supremacy, which means a black person can actually see another black person as a non-being because of the kind of institutional practices that we have inherited and that we're actually struggling to transform.
Would that explain why would a black force attack a black man in his yard in a black-led government? Because you see, it's chalk and cheese. In America, majority white. In South Africa, majority black. Force, black. Victim, black.
Yeah, it explains that, because here we have to look at white supremacy can still continue in the absence of the white man. So here we're talking about white supremacy becoming the normative vision of society. And we haven't kind of dealt with that. So which means that a black person is capable of wearing the lenses of white supremacy to view another black person, because the person who's doing the viewing themselves could have been the victim of the same system. So if the system has dehumanized me, which means I'm going to see the non-person in the another person, and that's how white supremacy has been able to perpetuate itself. And it becomes even worse, because we are a cultural majority.
Yeah.
But the culture is foreign.
Okay.
And when the culture is foreign,
hold that thought, Mechi, because before I get carried away, I have to go to news headlines, and then we'll pick up when we come back.
Power Talk, 9 a.m. to noon.
24 minutes to 11. We are also taking your calls, by the way, 0861-987-000. So we continue with our discussion, based mainly on the incident that took place in the U.S. Our guests, Siseko Khumalo, editor of Journal of Decolonizing Disciplines, Mechi Makgoba, political analyst. So, Mechi, there's a point that you were making. If you can just conclude it, because I want to go back to Siseko and raise the issue of South Africans and our level of activism in times
okay.
like these.
As I was just saying that, first and foremost, in South Africa, we could be black, and in numbers, but in terms of culture, in terms of our identity, who are we? And that's a very big question. And this type of things play out in terms of how we engage the police, yeah. where you see a policeman hitting another black person. And as I was saying that, you could be black and see another black person through the eyes
yeah.
of a white person, to be precise. Okay. And which definitely means that we are actually struggling to see ourselves as human in the context of South Africa, where you see a policeman killing another black person for actually a minor thing.
Okay. So Siseko, what then happened to us? What happened to us in our culture of social activism? You know, you hear parents complaining about the opening of schools, but the anger is on Twitter. You hear people enraged about what happened to Khosa. The anger is on social media. You hear people complaining about all kinds of things in this country, you know, the social grants, unemployment, a crime. What happened to taking to the streets and saying, this has got to stop and it has got to stop now? Because that's what I think politicians in the main are afraid of.
Thank you for that, my good colleague. I think one of the things that I'm sort of going to latch onto is what our colleague from the United States mentioned earlier, which is to say that in most instances, these protests that they're having in the USA are usually peaceful, and then it is the police who instigate violence amongst the people. And I think in the South African context, I am afraid of activism on the streets, as it were, right? And the reason why I'm afraid of activism on the streets is because of the history of this country and the violence that has always been meted out against Black people. And if you think back to in many instances, let's just go back to 2015, 2016, over to 2017, right, over our university campuses where students were protesting peacefully, for the change of curricula, for decolonization, et cetera, et cetera. And what happened was that when the police forces came onto our campuses, the police instigated the violence, right? In many respects, in 2015, the conversations that were being held across our campuses were peaceful conversations until university administrators invited the state, the force of violence onto our campuses through police, right? And we know this as well. In 1976, in this country, students, you know, they had nothing but hope, right? And what subsequently happened is that you have police firing live rounds, right? And again, the cheapening of Black lives. So when a vast number of South Africans, Black South Africans, take to social media, I'm a bit comforted by that, because I'm afraid of the bloodbath that could happen in this country. We saw it in Marikana a couple of years ago. You know, everywhere where police are, where black people just come out to express their disdain or their displeasure with a particular system, what we see in society is that police respond with violence against Blackness, whether it's in South Africa, whether it's in the United Kingdom, whether it's in the United States of America. Right. And so to me, I think the challenge would be, how do we protect Black life and not waste and squander Black life? And for me, that suggests a very, very delicate balancing act of expressing our discontent, but at the same time, preserving Black life.
Good point there you are making. 0861-987-000. I know you've been holding for quite a bit, but Zweli as well has been holding for quite a bit. Let's go to Zweli, South African national studying in the US. Zweli, good morning.
Hello, Tabi.
How are you? Are you safe?
No, we are trying.
So what has been your experience, Zweli?
No, so it's been a really tough experience, right? So, because firstly, you hear police sirens and then you wonder what's going on, because as a Black person, we are not exempt from what's going on here. So you might be thinking of going to buy bread, then the next thing you are being taken and put into a van, because some people are just picked from the streets and assumed to be protesters. So those fears are double for an international student, because then you think about if they put you in prison here, your visa, by the time you need to renew your visa, you'll be in trouble, because you'll be like, hey, what will you do outside? But you're going to buy bread, you know what I mean? So the fears are a bit...
You could become an innocent victim and end up losing big.
Exactly. And we've seen this in protests. We were part of student protests back in SA about 2016. So we know that even just innocent students going to do what they are doing in their normal day life, they get affected, they get picked up by the police, assumed to be protesters. So
you are not participating in the protests yourself because, you know, you've got quite a lot to lose, I suppose.
Of course not. I think any international student, even though they might be activists at heart, they should not, right? You can't participate in this because for you, the consequences are dire. Just one arrest, your visa is going to be in trouble when you renew it, right? So it's going to be a huge problem,
Zweli, stay put, my brother. Tough, I think, focus on the bigger picture for now. There are enough people on the streets. You know, you can join spiritually and otherwise. Zweli, thank you. Thank you and be safe.
Via social media,
Thank you. That's Zweli. There was a South African studying in the U.S. He says that, you know, the consequences could be quite big for a student like him in America, because if you're arrested under the guise of having done something illegal while during the protest, then, you know, you could be sent back home. Selo, Mudimolle.
Hello, Tabiso.
Yes, good morning.
I have long think that you have got a panel with you that would assist some of us.
Yes.
Tabiso, I have repeatedly been saying to you, when a revolution is not complete, normally, the capitalists will take advantage of the whole situation. Look how long the Americans got their independence, around 1793. It's almost over 400 years. The black Americans, because they are in the minority, found slavery and colonialism having been handed over. While we would agree that, slavery was abolished, but in actual effect, it was handed over to the feudalist, it was handed over to the capitalist. Now, look what is also happening. Critical question that I would ask to that very panel of yours is, this slavery is still there up until today in America. But there is a lesson that we must learn as South Africans. Is our revolution complete, Tabiso? I am asking you, and this could be my 20th time.
They have noted it. They have noted it, Selo. Yeah. Thank you. Before you respond, gentlemen, let me take the last two. Marcelo in Observatory, Tobel.
Ashe.
Yes, ma'am.
Hey, man, this is so awkward, right? Because I don't know if we can comment on American when we don't do a community standstill in South Africa. Black lives don't matter in South Africa.
Yeah.
That's why Batsoba reacted to the American thing. But
So I get what we're trying to do is to draw lessons and common issues.
No, but until we learn to become a cultural majority in ourselves, and not even the media or the analysis side, the community side.
Okay.
Rena Esbatu, the community of America went to the streets. Rena Esbatu, Rapanula.
Okay.
And then when white people happen things, Afriforum Yaba Emila, then draw complaint.
Okay. Marcelo, point taken, ma'am. Mem Rungwa, Fosloras?
Morning. Ours is not different from America, but ours is painful in the sense that it is very subtle. It's underground. It's so pretentious, you know, that everything is fine. They are hitting us kaholo when it comes to economy, when it comes to the judiciary system, where the system is still there. It's tight, and it's been run by this country. So we are not better. Are worse because we come on TV, we do everybody give a picture, everything is fine. Until such time that you get your economy, you're not better than them.
Okay. Nemronga in Fosloras, thank you very much. I'll give you an opportunity to respond, gentlemen, in a few seconds.
Power Talk, 9 a.m. to noon.
11 minutes to 11. So, Dr. Makgoba, what did you make of what some of the callers said?
I wanted to pick on the issue whether are we different from the Americans or not. And I think that we have to be honest with ourselves and conclude that we are living in an apartheid capitalist state where the decision-making structures of the country have two issues. Number one, they are white supremacists, and they are historical. And black people have kind of been assimilated and integrated into those systems, which do not recognize their humanness and which do not recognize their being. And as a result, white people are still occupying a more dominant position in terms of whether it's the economy, whether it's the culture. And that has really been perpetuated or reflected in how we experience violence as a society. Because if our framework of culture is foreign to us, it means that by virtue of that, our being, it's not valued, because that which should affirm ourselves is existence. It's only white supremacy that is running this country. And that has been reproduced in the education system, the legal system, in all sectors of the economy, where black people have to assimilate and find their space, whereas the historical practices of white supremacy and colonialism are still much intact and in existence. And where you see, this is more visibilized when you see the death of black people,
yeah,
whether it's through Marikana, whether it's through the police killing of innocent people. Those are just a reflection or reproduction of larger structure of white supremacy, which is very historical in nature.
Do we have any compelling reasons, Siseko, for us to be saying today, after so many years of our democratic dispensation, that we are no different from African Americans?
I think, that's a bit of a hyperbolic claim for me, right? And the reason why I say that is because, on the one hand, positions and democratic institutions in the country, we are the majority. The culture in South Africa is shifting in many respects. It's taking a while, right? It's 25, 26 years post-democracy. It's taking a while, which goes back to that question that was raised by one of our colleagues who called in and asked, have we completed the revolution in South Africa?
Mm.
And I would suggest, in many respects, on the socio-political front, we control the institutions, right? And I think for me, part of the work that needs to happen is that blackness has to get over this internalized inferiority complex that, of course, has internalized over centuries of oppression, domination, subjugation, and colonial imposition in our context, right? But we have to get over that in order to be able to infuse our democratic institutions with our own identities and our own cultures, right? And then to move on to the second question that one of your colleagues asked, which is to say, where are we? Where's the solidarity within our communities?
Mm.
I again raise the question of caution. Right. We have to take into cognizance that at the moment in this country, we have nearly more than 70,000 SANDF forces on reserve. What the hell does that mean? I don't know, to be honest with you, because as necessarily pointed out, the president hasn't answered any questions. The president is not taking questions. And there's a massive lack of transparency with how this government is ruling at this moment in time. However, that 70,000 plus SANDF forces on reserve means that if the government suspects or feels, I would suggest, that there's an insurgency in this country, that there's a revolt in this country, think about the bloodbath that would happen. Think, and again, abantu abamnyama abayobulawa ngani ngoba abelungu abayikhathazile ngokuthi thina nje abantu abamnyama siphila kanjani kule lizwe.
Mirwa, you've been holding in Midrand. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, sir. Go for it.
Yeah. Clinical example, a lady was suffocated by a soldier. It Paula Kwamhlanga Mall on Saturday.
This right? Past Saturday.
Correct. Now this military guy, remember in black malls, they send soldiers to come and manage the Jews. Here in Africa Mall, here I don't see soldiers. Here in Main Lane or here in Sandin, I don't see soldiers. But now our people are treated very badly. So the lady was suffocated. Subsequently regained conscious when the police actually were trying to call the very same soldier into order, because soldiers were not supposed to be the ones that are actually dealing with the civilians or the citizens. The police must be first. If there's an issue that warrants the police to come in, the police must come in. And when the police sees needs maybe some form of help,
yeah,
that's where the defense comes in. Now, the incident has happened. The lady's been suffocated just for going to the shop. And then remember, when the queues are long, if you want to inquire or ask, because you maybe want to get your medication from your shop, whatever, we have to talk to a soldier and he tells you, go back to the queue. And then if you don't respond to that, then it suffocates you. That's power.
Now, that happened this past Saturday in Kwamhlanga.
This past Saturday.
I can't believe.
The sad part is, when the case was supposed to be open, it took long for them to be taken seriously.
Yeah.
They're saying, they were saying, oh, it was a security guard. But there are people who saw this incident. Okay. I hope that more released that footage.
Okay. Mira in Midland. So, gentlemen, I suppose this bears testimony to what we've been talking about. In a sense, it says to law enforcement agencies, if they are listening, they are at the core of democracy in this country, and the freedom for people to express themselves. They have a big responsibility of acting responsibly in order to help this democracy thrive, Michi.
Yeah, the issue of acting responsibly, it is even political, because let's break it down. There's the issue of personal responsibility, which is comes from collective political responsibility. And in South Africa, we haven't dealt with the issues of collective political responsibility, which means that the political system has to work for black people. And yeah. Everything else takes from that structure. And if the structure hasn't changed, which means all these micro activities which involve personal responsibility, whether the police should treat people differently or they should treat them with dignity, that has to come from that superstructure. It's not necessarily deterministic, but that is the actually logical way of looking at it.
Okay.
And
all right. That line went in. Yes, sir. Mechi, I'm just going to push for Siseko to also give me a response, because that's the point you made about people being afraid to express themselves on the streets because of the fear and the evidence that is on the ground that we have seen, you know, with the students, with Marikana, and many other cases as well. So this obviously explains, you know, the importance of law enforcement agencies in a supposed democratic society like ours.
Absolutely, Tabitha, and I cannot stress that enough, because I'll remind the listeners of a conversation that happened nearly 2 months ago, whereby Ulanduga, Advocate Mbofu, and I were considering the question of what the hell this lockdown means for democracy in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're seeing, colleagues, what we're seeing is that, you know, democracy is genuinely buckling at the moment, not only in South Africa, but globally, and it's buckling because of this COVID-19, it's buckling because of the contracting economies, it's buckling because of all of these factors, and people are feeling very, very frustrated. And again, governments are reading that as insurgencies, right? Which is why, for instance, in the United States, you're seeing curfews being imposed. You're seeing, defense forces being deployed on civilians. And that is a threat on democracy. And I do believe that in the South African context, again, we've seen the evidence. The history tells us that blackness always gets the short end of the stick. Our people are the ones that die at the end of the day. And for me, you know, I think it's that very, very fine line of saying, how do we keep the state to account? And I think that the judiciary and judicial mechanisms become very, very important, as well as the legislative arm of government, which is parliament, right? Which is to say, we need to keep our elected leaders accountable, because at the moment, it seems as though, you know, at the moment, and that's what we're seeing in this country. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Siseko, for talking to us, editor of Journal of Decolonizing Disciplines. Thank you. Also, thanks to our other guest whom we happened to lose on the line, but at least it was at the tail end of this conversation, Mechi Makgoba, who is a political analyst, and everybody else who dipped in. As I said, as soon as the Minister of Basic Education takes to the podium just after the news at 11, we'll definitely put her on air so that you can hear directly from what she says, so that we avoid interpreting what she might have said as somebody who is very concerned about what had happened yesterday or last night, because we are supposed to get a briefing from her, which was postponed, a postponement which follows a previous postponement, which was late last week. So we are seeing pictures, by the way, on social media of bottle stores that were fully stocked. One of the employees in one of the bottle stores here in Johannesburg says that they had to come to work earlier than they should because of the preparation that had to do with sanitizing the bottle store, plus, you know, stocking. And he thought that the stock was just too much for their market because this bottle store is in Melville. Now, the picture that we're seeing here, it's almost empty. almost empty. So the stuff that you used to buy, the stuff that is worth 80 rands, that you used to buy for 350 from these chaps, is the one that is left on the shelves, on the shelves as well. So your palate might as well continue with the stuff that you were compromising on. But yeah, I mean, I find it absolutely amazing that alcohol could be such a national key point, if you will, you know. And somebody was saying that the queues that I'm seeing, there's a tweet there, I don't know where it is, but this person was saying the queues that I'm seeing are akin to those that were there in 1994 when South Africa was ushering in a democracy in this country. It is as if people are going to vote. Whew, it's 11 o'clock. Let's go to news.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.